For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. A surge in voter registrations isn't unusual for an election year, but in the past 5 months, there's been a bit of a surprise. Both of the major parties failed to get the boost they wanted. Republicans make up 47% of voters, but only got 40% of the more than 45,000 new registrations. Democrats only got 28%, even though they make up 38% of the electorate. In fact, it was independents who captured 31% of new voters, even though they make up only about 15% of all voters in the state. Neva, did this surprise you?
Not really. This has been the trend that we've been looking at. And when you see the independent voters, the registration, they typically are younger voters, voters of color, first-time voters. I mean, these are folks that really have no party alignment, party affiliation. They just they want to be in the process, and they see independent as the place that they want to land. The libertarians, I mean, we're seeing a small group that are 2%, and I believe only 1% still of the total voter registration. Mm-hmm. So not a significant factor, but I do think that it's no surprise, and we also have to take into account that when we look at the numbers, when you mentioned the statistics on the registration, with 47% Republican and 40% of the new registrations still coming in as Republican, it still shows that the trend overall among the two major parties is that Republicans are faring very well in the state.
Now, Ryan, of course, the Democrats opened up their primary to independent voters. Do you think this might actually be impacting the Democratic registration?
I think it may. And even if it's not, you know, Anastasia Langhorne, the director of the state Democratic Party, she said it's not our job to have everybody endorse our brand or to join our team. It's the job of the Democratic Party to go out and make a case to these voters, independent voters, Democratic registered voters, and get them to show up and support Democratic candidates, get them engaged in primary elections, and then ultimately get them engaged in the general election, hopefully keeping them on the Democratic ticket. Now, that's where I think Republicans have made a huge mistake in keeping independents out of their primary system. You know, frankly, what this says to me, and Neva's right, and we've seen this trend going on for quite a while now, is that more and more Oklahomans, in particular, voters that are just engaged for the first time, a lot of new voters with State Question 788, the medical cannabis initiative that's going to be on the ballot later this month, a lot of folks engaged in the electoral process for the first time are disaffected by the two major parties. And I think that we've seen a breakdown in the two major party system. They are unable to account for all of the complex nuances that exist in the American political life today. And we should frankly look at other options, not just expanding primaries the way the Democrats have done for independents. We should look at other reforms to our electoral system so that we can better incorporate all of this range of ideas instead of trying to put them in two separate boxes.
I think it is significant that the 45,000 plus new registrations is trending well ahead of 4 years ago when we had the gubernatorial race. So I think with 2 million voters now in the state of Oklahoma, it definitely is changing the political landscape in terms of how any candidate, particularly statewide candidates, have to communicate not only to their base and their party, but to the broader electorate when we see the general elections in the fall.
But again, though, we've had a lot of voters registrations, it doesn't always mean more people at the polls.
Doesn't translate necessarily to the polls.
That's the hard part.
That's been the disappointing part all along.
And there'll be an interesting, I think that there's a sense that some of these voters, at least, are coming to the table because of State Question 788, which that's amazing, great to engage folks on a particular issue. But do those people return back in November for the general election?
And is that, in fact, even the case? I mean, there's always a lot of speculation when you have a very controversial state question like medical marijuana. But will that be the thing that galvanizes folks to come out and vote just on a state question? Will they vote on other things on the ballot, or will that not interest them at all? I mean, it will be interesting to look at this post-election analysis of this primary season and see what it really means.
It's the same thing that happens during a presidential election. You had a lot of people who registered last year to vote for, say, President Donald Trump. Will they vote in the primary? Or the midterm
on down the
elections.
Ballot.
I mean, it's difficult to say.
And the way we conduct our elections matters. It can determine the way what kind of government we end up with. In California, we recently saw with their primary system there, a top two primary system. Democrats and Republicans don't seem to like it, but a political scientist will tell you that it's had a moderating influence on their legislature and on their politics in general. In San Francisco right now, they've got they're still counting ballots because they have a ranked choice voting mechanism where people get to rank in order of preference their candidates for mayor. Yeah. And so I think that, you know, we really need to start thinking about how can we engage more people in our electoral system to account for the nuance and complexity that exists in the American political system today.
And speaking of elections, we have a little more than 2 weeks until the primary election on June 26th. Any predictions, Ryan? We'd actually talked about State Question 788. Where do you think that's going to land?
You know, I think 788 still stands a really good chance of passing. We've seen a lot of excitement and engagement both from traditional voters, but a lot of new voters coming to the table as well. There's been a lot of excitement at the legislature. I mean, the legislature, I think, seems to give us an indication that they know where this is going, because you have leadership, Republican leadership in the Senate and the House, now talking almost like it's a foregone conclusion that there will be a special session to develop regulations after this passes. You know, there will be a concerted effort. It'll be interesting to see in the last couple of weeks whether the district attorneys or the Sheriff's Association and others go on TV or, you know, do any sort of aggressive paid advertising to try to scare voters away from this issue. I don't know how much that will work. Some early polling indicates that there weren't a lot of undecided voters out there. It's difficult to get people from yes to no. It's a lot easier to get somebody from undecided to no. And if you have a limited pool of undecided voters out there, then your challenge to defeat the ballot measure is really difficult. And I think it passes.
And even there are both sides arguing about State Question 78, but nothing really big. I mean, we're not seeing some major TV
I think that we may very well see that in the last 2 weeks of this election. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that it passes. I think even some of the recent polling shows that it is starting to wind down a little bit in terms of support. Not dramatic at this point, but certainly showing as people are becoming more informed, paying better attention to the issue, and really looking at it in its totality, I think we're going to see some folks weigh in, and I think we are going to see a very concerted effort on the no side to defeat the measure. And so I think, as we've seen in many state questions in the recent past, they can be flying high and then within a few weeks crater in terms of public support. So I think the judgment's out. Frankly, I would say that there's every indication that there's a good possibility that it will be defeated. So I think Ryan and I probably are on opposite sides of the view on this, but it will be a fascinating, it will be dictated by turnout and who does turn out and whether or not they've really done their homework on the issue and really have a real grasp of what that question really entails.
Do you think, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say on another race, and if you want to go back 7-8, another race that I think, especially for our listeners in Tulsa, the Republican primary for district attorney there is something. You've got the incumbent, Steve Kunstweiler, and there are two challengers to the race that are coming from various points of criminal justice reform angles at the incumbent district attorney. That's going to be an incredibly interesting race, and you know, we've seen criminal justice reform be at the top of the agenda for the legislature, but they've ultimately, I think, you know, fumbled the ball on the really big reforms that have had to happen. The DA is the most important and influential individual in the criminal justice system in the state of Oklahoma, and how these elections are won or lost will have, I think, a big impact on the way that whoever becomes the next district attorney in Tulsa County, or even if the incumbent stays there, how they're going to administer their office.
And I wanted to talk about Republicans. There are a lot of incumbent Republicans who are facing challenges in their own party. And nationally, you've seen a lot of incumbents either lose in their primaries or have to go on to runoffs. Do you think that the incumbents, Republicans out there, are a little bit concerned that they might have to face?
I think every smart incumbent is running like they're behind, and they are running a very aggressive race to make sure that they get their message out to their voters once again. Incumbency is definitely a factor where it means, I think, in most instances, the incumbents do come back. There will always be those, you know, rare exceptions in a district where something else probably is dictating why that landscape is changing. But I think the bigger, you know, kind of the bigger takeaway right now in the primaries overall for Republicans is the fact that we have such competitive statewide secondary races where we're seeing a lot of early spending on the airwaves. We're seeing a lot of activity on the ground in the key 25 or 30 particularly high-impact Republican counties. And so it will be interesting to see. Do we get the traditional Republican base coming out in a primary, the predictable kind of voters that one would expect, or do we have, as a result of younger voters and others coming out for these other issues, do they weigh in and in some instances may alter some of these races at the last minute? So, I think for the Republicans, it's a much more contested environment, obviously, than on the Democrat side, but it'll be fascinating to see.
Attorney General Mike Hunter playing one of the most vicious negative ads. I watched it the other night on TV, and you know, I've been in politics for a long time. At the end of watching it, I was getting ready for bed. I was like, "Ooh, man, that hurt."
Well, and that's a race where you know, the incumbent didn't start swinging. I mean, he has an opponent in the race who clearly weighed in with a lot of money and and went pretty strongly negative, almost from the get go. Yeah. So that is a race that is thoroughly engaged on both sides, and clearly is going to be one of the highest spending, if not the highest spending, secondary race on the Republican side in the primary. So it really will be interesting to see how the public responds in this particular instance.
And Hunter's an incumbent in name only. He was not actually elected to this position.
But so. He is someone who's well known in Republican circles.
And he's
a lifetime of service in varying ways in the state. So certainly, a high profile among those likely primary voters. But you can easily get yourself positioned with a lot of money being spent to be in the hunt in a race like this. So we'll just have to wait and see how the voters sort that out. And you're right, when you start having a very intense exchange back and forth between two campaigns, the voters really then have a little higher threshold to really try to figure out, what do I really think about what's being said, and who do I really trust and believe the most ultimately.
And who of these Republican gubernatorial candidates in the primary, it'll be interesting to see in these closing weeks which of them thinks that they need to go, who becomes the target? Does Stitt become the target? Does Cornette become the target? Everybody, I think, is just accepting the fact that Lamb's going to be in the runoff. But who's going to be in that runoff
with
Lamb?
In a multi-way primary, that does become the issue. I mean, you usually have a breakout candidate, and then it's who is kind of the second tier candidates clustered, and who's going to be able to break out and get that just an inch ahead of everyone else and be able to make the runoff.
A GOP hopeful for Tulsa's Congressional District 1 shamed his fellow Republicans during a forum for not standing up to President Trump, especially in his treatment of women. The attack came from Danny Stockstill, who says if Republicans can't stand up and say they disagree with the president and the way he treats people, then shame on us. Neva, this seems like a pretty bold move in an Oklahoma primary.
Well, it was a bold statement without question, but let's take into consideration the makeup of that race. I mean, he clearly is a long shot. So, he's not in any of the polling or considered by any of the folks really, watching this race closely, someone who's, at the front of the pack, so he can kind of throw those grenades or make those points in these kind of forums and kind of shake it up a little bit and see what happens. But I think when you look at the first district Republican electorate and where they trend, they are a very conservative voting block of Republicans. And whether or not making some of these statements better positions you with some of those folks, it remains to be seen.
Ryan,
it was a miserable performance for everyone on that stage, and even if you got Senator Nathan Dom, who I think is considered the front runner for that, they asked him. He said, yeah, I'd say that Donald Trump, has been a good role model. And that's where I think that when we look at polling in Oklahoma, especially among the Republican primary electorate, Donald Trump is still very, very popular. But we've seen this around the country. Everybody from Paul Ryan, who's leaving Congress rather than stand up to Donald Trump, Mitch McConnell, everybody has capitulated to this nationalist demagogue because they understand that he can activate the electorate against them, that he has a better sense of the pulse of that nationalist electorate than they do, and that he can control that. And so we haven't seen anyone in the Republican Party, either nationally or in Oklahoma, really stand up to him. And here's a guy who has demonstrated utter contempt for the rule of law. He's presiding over one of the most corrupt administrations
right,
in modern history.
And that's why I was so surprised to have this
yeah.
candidate say that.
And so somebody say that, but then you come back and you see all of the front runners immediately double down on Donald Trump, and then go on to say some remarks that were pretty incredible. I mean, we had people attacking birth control. We had people attacking the idea of gender identity and sexual orientation. And this is Tim Harris. Tim Harris did that. A former district attorney, an attorney who should be more professional and have a better sense of things, playing into that that hyped up appeal to a tribalist base in the Republican primary the way that Donald Trump does, and foregoing any sense of decency. And that's where I've seen a lot of the Republican Party nationally has really abdicated their role to try to hold this president accountable. And as a result, he operates in a vacuum within that party. I think it's going to do lasting damage to the Republican Party over the next several years.
The actions of former Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt are getting headlines again this week. This time it's a testimony from a Pruitt aide who says the EPA chief sent her to get a mattress from a Trump International hotel room, as well as house hunting, booking personal travel to a football game, and job hunting at Chick-fil-A for his wife. Now, on Thursday morning, Pruitt did actually kind of laugh that off. But Ryan, it seems like every week there's something new.
Well, and that's really been the way that the Trump administration has dealt with corruption and controversy, is just to add to it. It makes it difficult to sift through all of the everything from, just to think it's been over a year since James Comey was fired. We're a year into the Mueller investigation plus. Everything that's happened with this administration, everything from moving us to closer to the brink of nuclear proliferation to ripping children away from
the
immigrant
drama.
Mothers.
Now we're really.
I mean, this all of the stuff that this administration has done, I think, has made it difficult for the critics of the administration to keep up with it. And we've seen the kind of this beleaguered opposition that's just almost resigned itself to the fact that it's going to get absurd. It's going to get more absurd tomorrow. So why try today? And that's, with the Scott Pruitt story, the idea, and, some people may say, well, it's not a big deal. She sent an email for her boss. She's a federal employee. When you're a federal employee and you're co-opting government resources for your own personal benefit and personal gain, that's different than having a personal assistant that works for you in the private sector or even on a campaign. This
right.
is a government employee. They're a charge of the United States government.
And he was using government like email and stuff to be able to do this kind of stuff. That's where it kind of gets a little bit dicey sometimes.
It does move from the political side of just the Democrat committee members
right.
Releasing the testimony to the ethics questions, because Ryan is right. I mean, the federal ethics rules do prohibit supervisors from directing their subordinates to carry out any kind of personal activity, personal errands, anything of the sort. So they do have an issue that clearly, I think, and many have said to this point, does need to be fully vetted. It does need to be figured out. And if there are issues there, they need to be addressed. I think the White House, when these questions continue to come up, basically is taking the position of we're not familiar at this point with a lot of the facts, but clearly they seem to be taking a little bit more of a wait and see till some of these issues are fully, kind of fully aired. So it is the political dynamic against against these other issues, which are very separate. And I think no question Scott Pruitt was going to be a guy that was going to be in the short hairs of and targeted by a lot of folks in his role as the EPA administrator. But that being said, I think it is incumbent upon the administration to get through this process, for Congress to get through their committee work and figure out at the end of all of it if something really has happened that they need to address.
An interesting dynamic in the current political situation is, for folks like me, who I look at Scott Pruitt as this corrupt actor in Washington. He was a corrupt actor in Oklahoma, corrupt actor in Washington. That's no surprise. But we live in this political dynamic where we're all in our bubbles, so for what I see as corruption, there's a huge segment of the American electorate that looks at him almost as a martyr, that look at him as somebody who's being attacked unfairly from the left, being attacked even from some Republicans in their own ranks. And so this idea that more and more, you know, there's, I don't think that there's a tipping point, right? I don't think that there's some point where there's one story and people are like, okay, we've had enough. I think that what happens is that these stories come out and everybody's previous positions are just reaffirmed. And then we keep moving on, you know, further and further entrenched.
And I think your point is right, Ryan, to the extent that many people believe that exactly what Scott Pruitt is doing in his role as EPA administrator is what they want to see done and have been waiting to see done in a Republican administration. Mm-hmm. So there is this huge political dimension to the bigger picture that I think does keep people saying, "Hey, beat up on the guy all you want. We just want him to continue to do what he's doing with respect to policy and being supported by the administration in that regard."
A vacancy in Governor Fallon's cabinet forces her to appoint current Labor Commissioner Melissa McLaughlin Houston as her Secretary of Education and Workforce. Fallon only has a few months left in office. Neva, why is it important that a person be in this seat?
Well, I think it's always important to have these roles filled. I mean, there is ongoing work that needs to be done, and it has been a revolving door, unfortunately. This is the third education secretary this year.
Yes,
so
this year.
I mean, hopefully this one will will stay until the changing of the guard. But it is important to have these cabinet positions filled, and certainly Melissa Houston is someone who brings great credentials. She's someone who Mary Fallon appointed as labor commissioner. At the time she appointed her, Melissa said that she would not run for the office. And so I think when you look at her career, I mean, she's someone who is well established in kind of the ability to maneuver and work within the framework of state government. And it was a logical pick, I think, in many instances. So I applaud and congratulate the labor commissioner for her new role as the education secretary.
And Ryan, it's got to be awkward because the Governor Fallon is term limited. Mm-hmm. So whoever is in whatever position they're going to be, they won't have a job come January.
Yeah, but you know, I think Melissa Houston is somebody who has demonstrated that, you know, she has a lifelong commitment to public service. This is just going to give her, I think, some experience and exposure in education, something that she said that she's passionate about. You know, she is the rare Republican political figure these days who has, you know, worked there. You know, she ran for the legislature way back in 2000. I was actually working on the campaign opposite of her, and we won, but it was by less than 100 votes. Bill Nations beat her in House District 44 by less than 100 votes. But even since then, and I think it's almost good for her that she lost that race because she moved almost, you know, into the bureaucracy. You know, she's been in the Attorney General's office. She's worked through several state agencies. So she's this rare Republican public servant these days who has a deep knowledge of both the political side of things and the public policy side mm-hmm. of things. So I think that, you know, we'll probably see a lot more of her, whether it's in some subsequent administration or if she ultimately runs for office herself. You know, she's developed a lot of credibility and expertise on a number of issues.
And certainly if a Republican wins the governor's office again, she could certainly be appointed again to cabinet education secretary or to whatever
or some
position.
Other post.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.